It's Wednesday, June 16th. An American president meets a Russian autocrat in Switzerland. We start here. President Biden and President Putin agree on this much. U.S.-Russian relations are at a low point. They have low expectations that'll change.
No, he cannot tame Vladimir Putin.
George Stephanopoulos has spent time with Putin one-on-one. He'll help us get inside his head. The warnings about a bloody summer of shootings in America's cities are coming true.
If we have politicians and other people that are saying we need to do things differently, when do we shift the power of who's accountable for the results?
Many communities look to cops as the answer, but do we need a reality check? And as mask mandates fall, it's an honor system keeping the unvaccinated safe.
Is that like inhaling secondhand smoke?
As reopenings gain steam, how worried should parents be about taking their unvaccinated kids into crowded spaces? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Devin Dwyer. Good morning. Brad's off today, and he's missing some dramatic scenes out of Geneva, Switzerland this morning. As we're posting today's pod, President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin are in the midst of their first face-to-face summit.
On the agenda, Putin's election meddling, human rights, and cyber attacks.
Topping Biden's agenda, of course, are those increasingly intrusive Russian actions inside the United States, those encounters with military planes over Alaska, attempts to influence our elections, and of course, those Russian-speaking cyber gangs that have been hacking critical American industries for ransom.
So the scale of this is something that I don't think this country's ever seen anything quite like it, and it's going to get much worse.
U.S. intelligence says Vladimir Putin is the man with all the power to make it stop, but what will it take? What does Putin actually want?
Look, hey, Putin likes me.
I think I'd get along well with him.
I respect Putin. He's a strong leader.
President Trump tried flattery to no avail. We've tried sanctions, diplomatic expulsions. None of it has seemed to work. So the big question this morning in Geneva, can Joe Biden tame Vladimir Putin?
The most famous American in Russia right now is Edward Snowden. Is he invited to Sochi?
Our George Stephanopoulos has spent more time one-on-one with the Russian president than just about any other American journalist. And he joins me now. George, it's great to talk to you. So President Biden told our Cecilia Vega this week that Putin is bright, tough, and a worthy adversary. What was your impression of him when you met him?
I think those three things are all true. He's bright, he's tough, and he is a worthy adversary. And I think the key to understanding Putin is he wants to be an adversary.
So what do you say to Americans who see Russia and you not only as a rival, but an unfriendly adversary?
Between major countries, there certainly always are some common ground and points of tension.
You don't interfere in another country's election so overtly, so proudly, if you don't want to get a reaction.
Russians are watching in amazement, and some right here in the Kremlin with delight, no doubt, at the post-election chaos in the United States.
But he's achieved a lot of his ends, to have more division in the United States, to have the kind of attention that he's getting. Where if Biden had his druthers, and you saw some of this in NATO and his European meetings before his meeting with Putin, he wants the focus to be on China right now. That's one of the big ways in which he defines his power. And he's been basically punching way above his weight as a world leader for years now by taking on that role.
And did you get the sense when you met him that anything we do can dissuade him from that approach? I mean, what
is he'll take? At your opening question, can Joe Biden tame Vladimir Putin? No, he cannot tame Vladimir Putin. No one can tame Vladimir Putin. I mean, now he is facing more opposition at home than he's ever faced before. And you see that's why he's lashing out so severely against his critics, starting with Alexei Navalny. But he defines himself by countering the United States. And you see how dismissive he is of all the questions about how he's taking on his political opponents, whether Alexei Navalny is going to die in prison. He was dismissive of the siege of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, saying, aren't you guys cracking down on political dissidents? And that's what you accuse me of, was basically his message. He will give no ground in a public debate.
This is not a contest about who can do better in front of a press conference or try to embarrass each other.
Which I think is one of the reasons that Joe Biden and his team decided they didn't want to have a joint press conference, because they knew it would just turn into something of a game.
But I don't want to get into being diverted by did they shake hands? How far did they talk? Who talked the most and the rest? Now, he can say what he said the meeting was about, and I will say what I think the meeting was about. That's how I'm going to handle it.
Were you surprised then when you asked Joe Biden if he thinks that Vladimir Putin is a killer, that Biden went there? Did that surprise you?
A little bit, but look at the sequence. The sequence was I was actually getting him to recall a story about his meeting with Vladimir Putin, where he famously said at the time, and it got a fair amount of attention at the time, it was years ago, that, you know, unlike George W. Bush, he looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and saw that he had no soul.
You said, you know, he doesn't have a soul.
I did say that to him, yes. And his response was, we understand one another.
So he told that story again in the interview, which then made me think about the question.
So you know Vladimir Putin, you think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So what price must he pay?
The price he's going to pay, well, you'll see shortly.
Tonight, Russia is firing back, bringing home its ambassador to the U.S. after what President Biden told George Stephanopoulos about Vladimir Putin.
I think he was striving to be candid and to appear tough in the interview. I think his aides were a little bit surprised that he went that far in agreeing.
Today, Putin making it clear Biden's statement did not sit well with him. I would say to him, be well. I wish him good health, he said. I say that without any irony, without jokes.
He probably didn't want to necessarily deal with all the fallout that came with it, but I don't think he was saying something he didn't believe.
We totally believe that, you know, Trevor is a priority with them.
Does that mean that a prisoner swap is likely?
Well,
possibly. We hope so. We hope so.
You know, these
the Russian side has been talking a big game on this potential prisoner swap. How do you read that? And do you think there's a chance these two ex-Marines actually get released?
The Russians are demanding a pretty high price. One of the world's most notorious arms dealer, Viktor Bout, is one of the people they want released in return. My honest answer is I don't really know. I don't know if Biden can go this far. What I do know is that it would be a fairly significant concession for the president to release somebody like Boat.
And so, George, what's your bottom line on what to expect out of this meeting?
I would be surprised if anything major happened. I'm prepared to be surprised. I would love to be surprised. But I think that certainly President Biden and Putin will both consider it a victory if they kind of go in, say their piece, go out separately, say their piece again, and then slowly move towards a relationship where they can at least deal with each other when they have to.
George Stephanopoulos, thank you so much.
Thank you, Devin.
Next up on Start Here, as gun violence surges nationwide, some police chiefs say the answer is to saturate the streets with cops. More after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We were warned it was coming, and now it's here.
Been another violent start to the weekend in Cleveland. Five people have been killed.
The bloody summer of 2021, the surge in gun violence that took hold during the pandemic is now gripping American cities, small and large.
A suspect is in police custody following this weekend's mass shooting in Austin, Texas, in which 14 people were injured.
A mass shooting in Savannah. 9 shot, 1 killed.
Last weekend, there were 4 mass shootings in just 6 hours. 38 wounded, 6 dead.
4 rapid gunshots. Pop, 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 pop.
Yesterday alone, 7 more people shot in one incident in Chicago. While at an Alabama water distribution plant, 4 more people were hit by bullets. 2 were killed.
In Chicago, we've done absolutely everything possible
and we need help.
Summer typically brings a surge in violent crime, as we know, but this year experts say it's happening at an alarming rate and threatening to reverse two decades of declining violent crime rates nationwide. Former San Bernardino, California Police Chief Jared Burguan knows those challenges well. He is an ABC News contributor. Chief, great to have you for this conversation, because summer was forecast to be bloody and deadly. It's here. It's playing out. If you were still in charge of a department, how do you prepare for this? How do you respond?
Really, the best short-term solution is to find a way to saturate the streets. And the mere presence alone and officers out there doing additional work has proven time and time and time again to at least stem the tide of crime in the short term. And really, as a police chief and as a police administrator, that's your only choice.
And so how do you do that, saturate the streets, when proactive policing right now is being so heavily scrutinized? Does that make the job harder?
And that's the problem. You know, when you look at the statistics and you look at the numbers and you try to do some type of intelligence-based or intel-based policing, you want to put those officers in the area to have the greatest impact, which tends to be in neighborhoods where you're seeing a spike in violence. But the problem is that when you do drop them into those neighborhoods where bad things are happening, well, then you have, disparate contact numbers in terms of who's getting contacted, who is getting stopped, and who's getting arrested. And that is problematic in today's national narrative about policing. And what are we going to do to change that?
And do you think that's a factor right now in this apparently horribly bloody summer that's shaping up? I mean, is it police withdrawing from communities, holding back? That's in part why we're seeing these numbers? Or is it the gun sales? What do you see as being the reason?
You know what? I think that there's never any one reason that contributes to, you know, what's happening. Undoubtedly, aside from just the regular patterns and the normal upswing that you'll see during the summer, I think undoubtedly police departments feel right now that there is a little bit of an extra element to this violence and what's going on because of a lack of confidence in the criminal justice system, a lack of respect. A lack of consequences. We know that there's a lot of criminal justice reform that has taken place in cities and counties and states across this country. When we do talk about this national narrative and whether agencies are backing out, I don't believe that police departments or police leaders are pulling out of neighborhoods that need resources. I don't believe that's happening at all. I think what does happen, though, is that there are officers that have to put that uniform on every day and go out there and do the work on the streets that may in the back of their mind think it's not worth it to be aggressive in the traditional way.
And is there a political component in all this? Do we need to see more from local leaders, elected officials, mayors, city council people in terms of managing the expectations of police? Is that part of this?
I think local leaders always play a role in it. And it's not just local, though. You need the support of the prosecuting attorney's office, the district attorney, the state attorney, the U.S. attorney's office. You need the support of the courts and the criminal justice system as a whole. So the police are one of three primary components on what ultimately happens in terms of being effective with crime. Yet we really only look at the police department and measure their effectiveness based on whether crime goes up or down. And so you hamstring the police by saying, what are you going to do, chief? What are you going to do to respond to this? And the chief really feels that they really have one option. We're going to saturate the streets. We're going to put together task forces. If we have politicians and other people that are saying we need to do things differently, when do we shift the power of who's accountable for the results? So when you do see crime spike and we're doing things differently, is it going to be the police chief that's responsible for it? I think it's a question worth asking, at least.
Yeah, tough summer to be a cop, no doubt. Certainly being a police chief right now has got to be one of the toughest jobs in America, and what's already shaping up to be a pretty bloody summer. Retired Chief Burguan, thanks so much for your time and perspective.
Thank you.
Cannons were literally popping confetti across California yesterday as the state, first to lock down during COVID, finally fully reopened.
And yes, as you saw me walk up the stage, move beyond mask coverings and move beyond wearing these masks.
Governor Gavin Newsom making the big announcement in Hollywood. Well, down in Anaheim, for the first time in over a year, smiles were back in full force on those rides at Disneyland.
We woke up at like 4 a.m. just to put on our makeup and ears and get ready for this day.
Yesterday he was wearing a mask and I couldn't see like his full smile. So today I get to see his happy face.
Visitors to Disney theme parks in California and Florida, which are owned by ABC's parent company, now no longer need to wear masks as long as they've been vaccinated. But Disney says they aren't going to ask for proof.
I know that Disney is going to take precautions, and as are we. We make sure to hand sanitize all the time, masks for the one who's old enough to wear a mask, and we'll still be socially distant.
CDC guidelines say those unvaccinated Americans need to continue wearing masks to protect each other, especially children. But it's an honor system, as in many parts of the country, and that's raising some concerns about what the impact will be by those who don't follow the rules. ABC's Ann Flaherty has been covering all this and leading our coverage of the CDC and the federal response to COVID. And it's great to have you for this conversation because, you know, seeing these crowds of people together again really makes me wonder about this honor system that we have for unmasking. You know, and should we really be worried about unvaccinated people breaching that code of trust?
So I think the easy answer to this is no. As a vaccinated adult, you don't need to worry. You can go to a big box store or walk through a crowd. And what these studies have shown again and again in real world situations, not just in the clinical trials, that you're not going to get sick. You're not going to transmit it. And if there is by some chance a breakthrough infection, you're not going to end up in the hospital. So that's really good news. But what I would say about this is that there are probably two big caveats.
I have an 11-year-old child and she has some health issues. And so I know there's people out there who did not get vaccinated.
First, there's kids. Younger than 12, they don't qualify for vaccinations yet. And there's the immunocompromised, so people whose immune systems just aren't built up to be able to protect themselves, even if they do get the vaccine. So it's really the more vulnerable among us that are still really at risk with this. But when you go back to, you know, the reason why we had these public health measures in the first place, Devin, was to protect the healthcare system. It, you know, it really wasn't about your individual risk. It was, you know, flattening the curve. Well, that's no longer a risk because the cases are low enough now.
But the bottom line at the end of the day is we got to trust people to do the right thing and to be honest in terms of their self-attestation.
And about 40%+ of the country is vaccinated fully, of course. But gosh, you go into a restaurant these days, 100% of the people aren't wearing masks. So just the odds are a lot of those people, some of those people, aren't vaccinated, but you're right. Saying that's not a huge problem at this point.
Well, it's, you know, the numbers clearly aren't adding up if you see that. But I think what we're seeing is that it's pockets of the U.S. where the vaccination numbers are low.
72% of Pasadena residents 12 and older are fully vaccinated, compared to 63% in Long Beach and 54% in all of LA County.
I think what you're going to see in places like San Francisco, Vermont, New Hampshire, you've got numbers over 70%. So children under 12 don't have to be vaccinated because the adults around them have chosen to protect them. And the immunocompromised are likely to be protected because the virus isn't going to have a place to go.
We are seeing a kind of a steady decline. It's a bit concerning because we're not reaching the goals we would like to be reaching.
But I think when you get into places, Wyoming as a state, for example, that has a very low vaccination rate, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Arkansas, all of those states.
Mississippi continues to have the lowest vaccine rate in the country.
We're 28% fully vaccinated, and vaccines can save lives.
What will happen is that these unvaccinated populations, you're pretty much almost as at risk as you would have been last January because the people around you aren't vaccinated. So that certainly becomes a problem.
And as you said, I mean, one of the biggest groups of unvaccinated people right now is kids, and you're a mom. And so you talk about these systems, restaurants, theme parks, box stores, schools, events, concert halls, where the honor system is in place. I mean, how do you make
it's
that
tough
call? Do you think it's safe to bring your unvaccinated kids into places where they say you can unmask if you've been vaccinated, but they don't enforce it? They don't check it?
Right. I mean, I think this is a problem. You know, my husband and I took the kids away for Memorial Day weekend, and we'd been pretty locked down throughout the pandemic. And our, you know, great plan to have everybody eat outdoors to protect the kids. It didn't work. We were stuck in indoor restaurants. And, you know, I remember my husband and I looking around and saying, well, gosh, I hope, you know, everybody here is being on the honor system. I hope that they are vaccinated. But, you know, one thing that has always stuck in my head is what the CDC has said about the virus being aerosolized.
Now they are stating clearly that, yes, the virus can be inhaled via these smaller aerosol particles more than 6 feet away.
Okay. I remember one expert we were talking to told our team that he kind of likened it to cigarette smoke, that this was sort of like smoke that would linger through in a room. So if you have a large number of people who are unvaccinated, is that like inhaling secondhand smoke? So I think it becomes the issue of, you know, how long do you stay? You try to be outside as much as possible and know your risk factors, know where you are. You're more safe vacationing in certain parts of the country than you are others right now.
And all the more reason to abide by that honor system. If you're not vaccinated, keep wearing that mask. It keeps other people around you safe as well as yourself to a certain degree. Ann Flaherty, thanks so much.
Thanks, Devin.
Okay, we're going to take one more quick break. Up next, the iconic American car that's bucking high gas prices and the green economy with a comeback. One Last Thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing.
Did you know that Norway sells way more electric cars per capita than the U.S.? Norway.
If you've seen car commercials these days, you know that eco is all the rage right now. Hybrid and battery-operated sedans, sport cars, SUVs, we're told they're the wheels of the future. GM says by 2035 it'll have phased out gas and diesel engines entirely. But in spite of all this, the Ford Motor Company is bringing back a gas guzzler.
Oh, it's an iconic brand that Ford has just nurtured over the years, and we're just so happy to have it back here at Michigan Assembly.
This week, Ford Bronco SUVs are rolling off a Michigan assembly line and shipping to dealers almost 25 years to the day after they were discontinued. The company says it sees an opening to make a profit on the car's cult following, which appears to still be going strong after 30 years in the spotlight. It was Bronco, after all, that carried the Pope on a 1979 visit to the U.S., a Bronco that blazed across the silver screen in Romancing the Stone and Invisible Man.
If you've been watching television over the past couple of hours, you've been watching the search for O.J. Simpson.
Of course, who can forget the 1994 high-speed chase with O.J. Simpson behind the wheel as that white Bronco sped down a California freeway.
The presumed vehicle of O.J. Simpson is still traveling very slowly northbound.
Ford says 125,000 Bronco orders are headed out the door so far, and those buyers don't seem bothered by low gas mileage. The Bronco's most efficient model returns just 21 miles a gallon. Compare that to a Toyota Prius Hybrid, which gets more than 50. Ford says its customers are buying into a lifestyle, one named after a wild or half-tamed horse that doesn't worry much about high gas prices. That's it for today's show. Brad will be back tomorrow with all the highlights and nitty-gritty from the Biden-Putin summit. Until then, I'm Devin Dwyer. I'll see you later. Thanks for listening.